The Industrial Revolution created a new way to produce food. Canning and refrigerated rail cars, all part of the early framework of what would become America's modern food system. The book Food Fights, How History Matters to Contemporary Food Debates, is a collection of essays on that and many, many other subjects, which scholars tackle everything from the failures of genetically modified foods to the rebirth and rebranding of quinoa. Joining us now is Charles Ludington, co-editor of the book and a professor of history at North Carolina State University. Chad, welcome.
Well, thank you. Good to be here, Frank.
Good to have you here. Let's talk about this. You know, this we talked about. Let's talk about the book itself and what it contains. The essays in this book. What are you aiming to do here?
Well, first of all, Matthew and I tried very hard. Matthew Booker.
Yes.
A colleague of mine in the history department at NC State, my co-editor. We tried very hard to bring together divergent voices who might talk or give different opinions about things and generally have fights. Polite civic fights, of course, but over food-related issues, to air as many viewpoints as possible. And we our belief is that if one side simply blames the other and refuses to discuss things, we won't get anywhere. So that by having a number of different viewpoints and having people genuinely disagree with each other, we might actually stand a chance of advancing somewhere and understanding the other side, too. So that's the framework of the book is sections that in which you have essays that speak to each other about certain issues and disagree in many cases vehemently with each other.
Well, let's talk about one of them. Born in the USA. This is written by Peter Kuklunas at mm-hmm. UNC Chapel Hill,
uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And he talks about the American industrial food system and really paints it as kind of the shining light on the hill for all of its advancements and all of the gifts that it's given us.
Yeah, no, Peter definitely has a more positive take on the current food system, especially as an historian of agriculture. He sees the current system as having solved the problems that it set out to solve in the 19th century, and that is it produces huge amounts of food, more calories than we need, in fact. Not that they're necessarily distributed in an equal fashion, but more calories than we need as a country. We export huge amounts of food, and he sees this as an engine of broader economic growth in America and, in a sense, something to be celebrated, given that in the 19th century we still had much greater amounts of food insecurity. We had genuine starvation-related diseases affecting large numbers of Americans. And to him, the very fact that those have been reduced dramatically is a real success. So he's going to get a lot of pushback, I think, from few people.
Let's talk about the pushback. Let's talk about I suspect that one of the arguments that Peter might face is that there are hidden costs here, that we're talking, this is not necessarily unfettered development and growth.
No, I think that's certainly where the pushback is going to come from, Frank. Peter acknowledges that the system isn't perfect, but many people are going to argue that that's glossing over too much imperfection, that there are hidden costs, as you say. There are social costs, that the reason our food is so abundant and cheap is because we overlook the laborers. We pay them very little. They're often illegal immigrants who are actually people, the big producers want them here so they can pay them even less because they're legal. Others are, of course, legal. Most of the food workers are, of course, legal, but they're still paid a pittance. Mm-hmm. And there are very few unions in food production and in food services. So that these people get paid a tiny amount so that the rest of us can have this abundance. And so that's certainly a major social cost. Then, of course, there are environmental costs. The so-called traditional way of agriculture, which became traditional only starting in the late 19th century, uses huge amounts of fertilizers, which then run off into streams, which cause algae blooms kill the oxygen in rivers and lakes and streams and the ocean and the animals and fish can't live there. So there's that problem. There's the pesticide problem. When you use too many pesticides, they're herbicides and all these things that are both bad for the environment and often we're still not exactly sure what impact they have on the humans who ingest them. Then you get into issues of animal cruelty. CAFOs, can we have a better system than these contained animal feeding
Contained animal feeding operations.
I just heard of them as CAFOs and then stopped.
Yeah, and of course they.
But there are all these things that need to be accounted for, and those are all costs.
Yeah, and so it's fascinating. So that's the argument there. It's given full throat. He talks about farmers as entrepreneurs, but of course many of them are actually locked into contracts as though they're franchise owners, and they're not really terribly entrepreneurial in the sense that they don't have much sovereignty over their operations.
Yeah,
days.
I'd want to let Peter speak for himself, but I think the entrepreneurial aspect that he's speaking of is really more of a late 19th and early 20th century part of the farming that he's thinking of, where farmers were embracing new technologies and thinking about ways to expand business, improve their yields, et cetera. But I think now, for the most part, you're absolutely right, that I'm not utterly convinced by the entrepreneurial aspect of modern farmers, given that the entrepreneurship comes at the broad corporate level, which owns huge farms. Whether, you know, the notion of a farmer out on the Nebraska plains thinking and being able to operate as an entrepreneur seems a little bit...
Can't even plant the seeds if they have genetically modified seeds, right? Because they're owned by the seed company.
The seed patents are owned by the big companies.
Well, let's talk about that. Let's talk about another essay in the book, Savior or Monster. It has its own argument right in the title, and we're talking about genetic engineering.
Margaret Mellon, or Marty Mellon's chapter is a wonderful chapter also, and she takes a very different look at the current food system and would disagree with Peter in many ways, in part because if Peter's big thesis is that science really has made things better and will continue to make things better, Marty, who has a scientific background herself, comes along and says that, you know, science promised a huge amount, especially with genetically engineered crops, what are often referred to GMOs, genetically modified organisms. She prefers the term genetic engineering because that refers to gene splicing and much more modern techniques of modifying crops, and says that given all the promise starting in the late 60s and the 1970s, ultimately genetic modification in crops or genetic engineering has done very little. It's killed a lot of bugs, is her big argument. But
well, it's also created some very, very resistant and resilient bugs. As it turns out, nature doesn't take this laying down, does it?
That's one of the problems. That you're absolutely right. And Marty points that out and ultimately argues for much more traditional forms of crop breeding and genetic modification through traditional methods, not through laboratory methods of gene splicing. So yes, as you said, one of the problems is that you can kill a lot of bugs for a certain amount of time. You can resist a lot of weeds for a certain amount of time, but both bugs and weeds very quickly reproduce and mutate and find their way around these things, and we have to throw a whole new group of chemicals at them or splice new genes and put them in plants so they can kill another slew of bugs. But the bugs work just as fast, if not faster, than the scientists, and that's a problem.
All right, and so let's talk about this, because we did mention quinoa in here, and I think this is another aspect of the entire food industry, which is the marketing. So talk more about this phenomenon, which has become crucial. I always laugh at this because I think about the amount of money spent marketing food, and it's just the silliest idea in the world. Like, I'm hungry, I will eat. You do not have to persuade me to buy food. How much money is spent persuading me to buy a particular kind of hamburger with a particular kind of cheese? What a waste. But anyway, so marketing to me is utterly fascinating when it comes to food. And I think this particular essay, you know, highlights some of that.
Well, I mean, I think quinoa is an interesting grain, in part because it seems to almost disappeared. It's from the Andes, and of course, it's making, as you're alluding to, it's suddenly very fashionable. And how did it make its way on? It's advertising. It also, though, appeals to, in many ways, its relative rarity. The fact that for consumers in North America, it's exotic in as much as it comes from South America and the high Andes. It has an appeal to a certain kind of purchaser that Margot Finn talks about, where she really, in a sense, sends up those people, which would include myself, who spend much of their time at farmers markets and caring about new grains and being excited about new foods that are on the available on the market, and saying that this is really class-based more than anything else. It's not, we might think we are doing good things for the world or for small farmers in Peru. And we might be doing that, but to a large degree, it's really more how we want to be seen in society. Right. I hope that quinoa becomes something that's incorporated just like, say, corn or was you know came from the Americas and was brought back by Europeans and Africans to Europe and Africa and spread to Asia right. very quickly and then found its place in the global food network. I would hope that quinoa and other grains that are attracted to a broad number of people become popular at a much broader social level than they are now.
Right. I mean, I think that's the point this makes, not that there's something anything wrong with quinoa or that we're fools for eating it. Not on the contrary, it's great that you introduce more and more greater variety instead of the monoculture we've become accustomed to in this country. Absolutely good, and absolutely good for farmers who in a part of the world that may have suffered. But what she puts a finger on is this class base that all of our decisions are based on consumption, and consumption continues to feed the monster that built the industrial system in the first place.
Absolutely. And that's where someone like Steve Striffler in his article says, you know, that's the problem. It's always about the consumers. It's always about the consumers. If we really want to change the food system, we have to focus more on producers.
On producers. And maybe put more producers in the system. I mean, again, it's a measure of success to say you have fewer and fewer farmers if you embrace a certain ideology and a certain logic. Yeah. Within that logic system, it makes perfect sense. It's more productive to put that land X, Y, and Z. But if you're looking at these other costs and social factors, it may make less sense to have fewer farmers. Maybe we need more farmers.
I couldn't agree with you more, Frank. I think that we do need more farmers. And that's really the way we're going to change the system if that's our goal. And certainly for me, I think that would be something that we want, which is food being produced on a smaller scale, but in a much wider range of places and by far more people. So both that's a form of employment, obviously, but it also we need that if we're going to scale down the size of production and make things more local. We absolutely need more farmers. Then the question is, how do you attract more farmers, given that, first of all, it's an incredibly difficult right. profession. It's subject to the whims of markets, to crop failure, the weather, soil. How do you make it safe for people to enter into farming? Because, of course, any farmer will tell you it's mentally stressful right. being a farmer. And then I think, we as a society need to maybe change a little bit we as consumers in particular need to change our attitude towards producers and really, I think, revere them in a way that we don't. So I think it's easy to romanticize the French and the Italians, but I think there is a real sense of, a farmer working the land, trying to make the very best X, Y, or Z, really has a cultural hold in certain countries the way it doesn't here. So I think, one of the things that I try to do in my own classes and many of my colleagues at NC State try to do is really push the idea that farming is something that we should admire. Farming's hard work, right. but what comes at the end of it, good food, is something that we should all appreciate. We all need to take the time to savor the food we eat and think about the food we eat. And that's an important part of a good life. And it also helps to create, it requires more farmers.
It requires more farmers, but it's economic development up the chain, too. There's a supply chain that could then be filled in by more processors. If the emphasis is on local, having more processors in localities where these things can then be turned into, upper scale products, again, generates economic activity.
Yes.
I don't know why anybody who's concerned about rural development doesn't say more farmers and more processors in rural areas is at least part of the answer.
Yeah. No, I think you're absolutely right. And here the question really is, who has power? And the large corporations would probably nod and say, that's wonderful, Frank. We're all for jobs. But for them, consolidation is what creates their bottom line and their profit. So I think what we're fighting against is the consolidation and the economies of scale, and we want to break that down. We're not saying certainly I'm not saying, and again, I'm only one of the authors in this book. So I want to make sure I don't speak for everybody else. But I think that if we're going to change the system in a way that I feel would be healthier, it's precisely that. It's breaking things down. It's not getting rid of right. markets altogether. It's not becoming using the communist model of food production. Instead, it's breaking down the scale and thereby providing more jobs, as you said, at a variety of levels of food production, and that's still very much market-oriented.
Well, then the market can really speak. How much choice do we have when soybeans are in everything? I have much more choice at my farmer's market than I've got at my local grocery store where there's a soybean in every can.
You're absolutely right. I'm sorry. Soybean and of course, corn, too.
So if the market speaks, the market says, give me more products, not fewer.
But I think it's really, how do we create a market that is smaller, that it has a number, or the scale is smaller, and it has a number of people who are operating, far more number of people who are operating at the local level than at the big consolidated national level. And that's really the key. And I think that's where you need consumers who demand that, and you also need legislation. But that's a tough sell when you have the big corporations are able to then pay the senators and the congressmen to maintain a system that maintains their bottom line. And so consumers, I think, really need to take this into their own hands or stomachs and demand things that will help to create a different type of market.
Charles Ludington, co-editor of the book Food Fights, How History Matters to Contemporary Food Debates, also a professor of history at North Carolina State University. Chad, thanks so much. Good to talk with you.
Wonderful to be here, Frank.
Coming up on The State of Things, the rich heritage of Jewish music. You'll hear it right here. Stay tuned.